Box to Box Stoppage Time.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse.
Great savings every day.
And Hoyt's Herbs and Spices.
Changing the mood of food.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
Hello and welcome to Box Stoppage Time. You're with Rob Gilbert, Derek Dyson, and a virtual Michael Edgley for our podcast where we go through our highlights of the past week, our teams and moments of the week and plenty more. Now, Derek, it's an interesting version of Stoppage Time. We tried it out with our man in Hong Kong in the main show earlier the week where he dropped in his assessment of the Matildas Olympic group in World Cup Corner. So we're going to give it another crack, and he's pre-recorded his little packages here, which we're going to insert throughout the show. So, you know, famous last words, but it's going to go beautiful, isn't it?
I think as always, I mean, Edge is a pro, you're a pro. I think the listeners will barely notice that these have been pre-recorded.
You think they will? Okay, well, I think the one pro you haven't mentioned is our good friend Adam Maloney, who's going to make sure that if our listeners don't detect it, then they will give him the lion's share of the responsibility. All right, well, look, to make it nice and easy, why don't we give Edge the first crack at it? His game of the week was the A-League Women's Newcastle comeback against Melbourne Victory.
Throw in, Ayres, quick to turn, quick to shoot, quick to score! Ties it up for the Jets. And it felt inevitable that Melina Ayres would come back to haunt her former club. For the first time, she scores against the Victory. And it's also her first goal in the Liberty A-League since the 14th of October. Normally, they are always looking to drive forward, and that's what Gooch is trying here. Ball slides on. Allen, dangerous. Ayres, shot onside. Incredible! Melina Ayres puts Newcastle into the lead. If there was one name, if there was one player that you needed to score a goal, it's Melina Ayres.
Well, Rob, I'm sure that you could have guessed that my game of the week will be the A-League Women's contest between the Newcastle Jets and Melbourne Victory. On paper, it didn't seem to be a significant game of the week, but it was an important match for Newcastle Jets. They were playing for their survival in the finals race. And there was an incredible backstory to this match. Obviously, Melbourne Victory this year have spluttered along. They haven't really hit their straps, and they've really missed their gun striker, Melina Ayres, who left them last season for Newcastle Jets. Unfortunately for Melina, she'd had an injury-interrupted season. She'd had a problem with her hip. Melina had also had some glandular fever and some concussions, so she really had spent a lot of time on the sidelines. Only in the last 2 weeks had been able to come back and play some short periods. So the underlying theme of this match was, could Melina Ayres come back to haunt Melbourne Victory? Melbourne Victory needed to get a draw or a win to assure themselves of a spot in the finals. They started well, they got a goal early. Rachel Lowe, who has scored 11 goals this season, really playing out of position as a striker. Everybody knows that she's probably more effectual as a 10, but they've really struggled in their striking ranks this season. So Rachel stood up, she got the go-ahead goal. Lauren Allen, who's a really significant stalwart for Newcastle Jets, got an equaliser before half-time, but Rob, all the action happened in the second half. It was an amazing, amazing scenes in the second half. Melbourne Victory went ahead by 2-1 with Tori Hansen getting on the end of a deep cross from Jamila Rankin, and they looked like they were comfortable, but the Newcastle Jets, onto the field came Melina Ayres, and it changed the game. We know that Melina has some serious quality. She's almost scoring at a goal a game. It's amazing to see that, really, considering how many matches over the last three seasons she's missed from injury. But she came on for 22 minutes and just tore her former team apart, scoring 2 goals to get Melbourne Victory, a Freudian slip, isn't it? To get Newcastle Jets the win and keep their finals hopes alive. You really could see on the faces of the Melbourne Victory players, I'm sure they just thought that was Melina doing what Melina does, but it was an epic contest, and it ended in serious controversy with Emily Gilnick and Melinda Barbieri having a bit of a tussle, and Izzy Nino, the American goalkeeper for the Newcastle Jets got involved and happened to get herself a red card. So she'll miss the important last round against Adelaide in Adelaide for Newcastle. But, Rob, that Newcastle Jets match, 3-2, their finals hopes are alive, and Melbourne Victory go to Sydney to play Sydney FC, their nemesis, and they need a draw to make the finals, at least. Yeah, very interesting. And what about Melina Ayres? We can't say enough about her on this podcast. We obviously all know how we've all got a bit of a relationship with Melina, but she has delivered in spades for Newcastle Jets, and it was incredible emotional scenes at the number two sports ground in Newcastle. It was packed, and the Newcastle fans were standing on their feet applauding a remarkable 25 minutes from a remarkable player, Melina Ayres. That's my game of the week. Well done to Melina. Well done to Newcastle Jets. And Melbourne Victory, they have to pull their socks up, go to Sydney and get a result.
Now, for those of our listeners who may be unaware, a disclaimer, Edge does manage Melina Ayres, but under the circumstances, for a player he's known since she was 8 or 9 years old, I reckon he has every right to be proud. It's been a pretty challenging year for Melina, moving to Newcastle and putting some closure on that move against the side that gave her her chance. And in a bittersweet moment for our mate Michael, he also happens to manage four of the Victory women, one of whom was Paige Joyce, who was the player that Melina Ayres rolled off to score her first. So he's got to be a little bit of a diplomat. Maybe that's why he hasn't turned up live this week, Derek.
Well, it could be, but you know, in all due respect to Edge, I think he's allowed to champion his girl. So I'm pleased to hear that they're all going well.
Yeah, it was a brilliant moment. And well done to Melina Ayres and Newcastle. Great comeback. One more round of the women's A-League to go this week, and the final spots are yet to be decided. Now, my game of the week was England v Brazil at Wembley. Now, Derek, this was the first outing for the Three Lions since we discussed them, and you self-declared the team you love to hate, but so chock-a-block full of talent is this English side that we had expected some pretty big things against Brazil. But when you listen to this little clip next, you'll sort of sense the disappointment in a jam-packed Wembley when the latest Brazilian prodigy, yes, a 17-year-old Endrick, smashed home the winner with 10 minutes to go.
Andreas Pereira, after Dunk headed it to him, now through the middle with Vinicius. Vinicius with a chance, it bounces to Endrick, who might have been in an offside position. No, the flag stays down. And Endrick, the 17-year-old, scores his first goal for Brazil here at Wembley Stadium against England.
So let's put this into context. England were missing Harry Kane and Bukayo Saka, amongst others, but the Seleção were injury hit themselves. You know, it had been described as a virtual second string side. The coach, Dorival Jr., it was his first match in charge of the national side, under a massive amount of pressure to start a new era on the right foot away from home in one of the most hostile environments that there is in international football. They'd crashed out, as we know, of the last World Cup in Qatar in a quarter final penalty shootout against Croatia. So, Derek, you've seen England now. Were expectations too high? The pile on against Gareth Southgate has re-emerged again. Do you think only a win in the Euro saves him? So what's your thinking on all that?
Well, yeah, we were talking last week about just how talented this team is, and I was sort of speculating as to whether Gareth Southgate had the resources and skills available to pull this team together. There is deficiencies in it as well, particularly in at the back. I don't feel like anyone can argue with the forwards that don't even make the starting 11. But you know, I think John Stones has got a hell of a job back there with Harry Maguire and the sometimes flaky Jordan Pickford. But yeah, England were missing Luke Shaw. They'd argue that's their number one left back. Obviously, Kyle Walker went off in the game, so they were missing probably four of their starters midway through the first half. But I think what England have demonstrated yet again is this inability to work out how to play against so-called big teams. I take all your points on board around Brazil's own woes when it comes to selection, the fact that the manager is new, the fact they're away from home at Wembley. I wouldn't say it's a hostile environment. Yeah, it's tricky, but it's not like a
cauldron. Do you remember the final of the last Euros?
Well, yes. I mean, there were some dickheads, wasn't there? But, I wouldn't describe it compared to going to Maracanã or Azteca or some of these places. I'd say it's it's second rate, I must admit. But not diminishing that at all. Brazil were great on the counter attack. Got the job done. I think England ran out of ideas. I think they showed that, you know, at least with this iteration, that the bench wasn't particularly strong. But I also think it's hard to, you know, you take Ollie Watkins and you start him, and he's been in sensational form for Aston Villa, and just go, right, now we've got to go against Brazil and bag a load of goals. It is difficult, but I think it just demonstrates again that England against big teams, whether it's France, twice against Belgium at the World Cup, and more recently against Italy and obviously Croatia as well. They just don't get past these teams very often. So I think the same question mark still remains. They're great in qualifying. They're great flat track bullies. They've got an amazing opportunity now. They will go into the tournament as one of the favourites, along with France in particular, and they'd probably have a good chance of winning. But until they can build a winning mentality and beat these teams at home, you're right. They were struggling. They should have won. And yes, they were missing Harry Kane. Yes, they were missing Bukayo Saka. But I think they had enough on the pitch to get the job done, and they didn't. So jury is out, as far as I'm concerned, for England at the moment.
And Gareth Southgate, a win keeps his job, a loss.
I don't know. Oh, you mean against Belgium?
No, I'm talking about the Euros.
The Euros. I mean, yeah, because I mean, I think they've got a win against Belgium in the next game. I think that's pretty important. And that will have happened because, well, by the time we've put this to air. But I don't know if you're continuing the job after this tournament anyway. I think this is his last assignment. So I don't know if it's a case of keeping in the job. I think it's a case of, will he go down as one of the all-time great England managers? There's no doubt that England have had much better performances, even at major tournaments under Gareth Southgate, compared to Sven, who I'm going to talk about in a bit, and Capello, and some of the other managers that have been in charge. Terry Venables. But, you know, until he brings home the piece of silverware and ends that, you know, Three Lions song, then, yeah, I think the jury's out.
Yeah, no. Well, he's still got the chance. Who knows? This all might be moot because he might go along side of Sir Ralph Ramsey on that pantheon. Okay, now you've already mentioned a former England manager, and it's not very often we see football with as big a heart as it showed last week in your game of the week, mate. Set the scene.
Yeah, I felt this was quite an easy one in a way. I mean, I wasn't that inspired by any of the friendlies and, you know, some of the competitive games. And of course, we're hamstrung that some of these games will have happened by the time we get to air. So I plucked out the Liverpool Legends game versus Ajax Legends. And, you know, these games are hardly outside of, you know, the hardcore Liverpool fans, for example, in this occasion, these games hardly pass without a lot of comment. Most teams do them. But it was really just an excuse to discuss the amazing tribute to Sven Goran Eriksson, who took charge of the Liverpool team. Of course, the Swede has been diagnosed with a form of terminal cancer a few months back, and that prompted Jurgen Klopp to essentially say, you know, if he wants to come and manage us for one game, I'll happily step aside for one game. And obviously this was the perfect environment for him to do it. The fact that Sven is a Liverpool fan, you know, he's been pictured next to the famous This Is Anfield poster in the past, and he had the chance to do that. And the ovation that he got from the people at Anfield, people of Anfield and Liverpool, was outstanding. The standing ovation that he got, you could tell he was walking out very gingerly. He's obviously not in a good way. And I thought it was very brave of him to do this. Like, he's clearly not well, but he was smiling from ear to ear. Liverpool captain Steven Gerrard on the night said that as soon as he heard Sven was the manager, he said that he couldn't wait to play for him one last time. You know, as a result, the Liverpool Legends came from 2-0 down to win 4-2, included on the goal scorers. I mean, these are kind of footnotes, really. Gibril Cissé, Fernando Torres, amongst others. And look, we'll speak more about Sven in detail at another time, I'm sure. But, you know, for me, it's well done, Liverpool. Well done, Sven Goran Eriksson. And, you know, sometimes things are just bigger than the game.
Yep, no, nice story and well said, mate. No time to gloat about club allegiances here. It was just a good football story all round, and we wish Sven well with his battle, which against pancreatic cancer is one of the toughest that there is. Okay, Edge's team of the week's coming up next. So it's the Oli Roos after Tony Vidmar guided them to the final of the West Asian Football Federation. Now, it doesn't get them to the Olympics yet, but sets them up. And again, this is the nature of podcasts, because many of our listeners will be tuning in after the result of this. They might be the champions of that tournament by the time you do tune into us. But I think Edge's points, nonetheless, are well made.
Rob, well, obviously, in the last 7 days, most of the Olympics discussion in football has been about the Matildas and their draw. So my team of the week, it's not the Matildas, it's actually the Oli Roos, who've made the final of their warm-up competition in pretty spectacular fashion. They defeated Egypt, their under-23 team, in a penalty shootout to qualify for the final. They're going to be playing Korea Republic in the final. It's been a really good performance by the Oli Roos. They are underneath the radar in comparative terms to the Matildas, only because it's an under-23 competition, the Olympic Games for men. Obviously, we had a fantastic result at the last Olympics, not only qualifying, but defeating Argentina. And Marco Tilio, it really did set his name up in the headlights. This under-23 Oli Roos team, Rob, packed full of A-League players. So it is a vote of confidence for the A-League competition, which is the primary proving ground for these under-23 players. And it really was, so far, a very promising performance. I was a little bit sceptical about the Oli Roos getting through to qualify for the Olympics, because it's so difficult. There's only two spots available for Asia at the Olympics, so they've got to finish in the final to do that. And then there is a playoff spot, so if they finish third, they will qualify for a playoff spot, but automatic qualification, only two spots. So it's going to be difficult, that 16-team competition in the Asian under-23 qualification route. So the Oli Roos doing everything right at the moment, you'd have to say, and this performance by reaching the final of the competition that's been held in Saudi Arabia at the moment is something to be proud of the Roos, and it really does give them a lot of confidence and the football community a lot of hope that the Oli Roos might join the Matildas at the Olympic Games in France in July and August of this year.
Now, Derek, back to the Euros, which we talked about in the main show, and we've already referred to. My team of the week is Germany. Now, we've talked a lot about pressure, Gareth Southgate pressure, Brazil pressure. Pressure is just football. But the Germans will be hosting this tournament after they missed the playoffs in the last two World Cups. They went out in the round of 16 to England in the last Euros. Germany sacking coaches. Well, Hansi Flick got the flick after Yogi Löw outstayed his welcome, and now they're relying on a rookie, Julian Nagelsmann, who's got a great CV, but he's also been sacked by Bayern, and his job is to put the Mannschaft back into their, well, what I think any football observer would refer to as a natural position as one of the world leading football nations. Now, they've taken their first tentative steps back to the promised land with a win over a strong French side in Lyon. Now, it was a friendly, of course, but to underscore a statement when it included a goal after 7 seconds to Florian Wirtz as Germany ended a three-game winless run with a comfortable win. It was the 20-year-old Leverkusen man's first goal for his country. And as we mentioned in the main show earlier in the week, it would have been the fastest international goal on record had Austria's Christoph Baumgartner not scored after 6 seconds in his country's friendly against Slovakia earlier on the same day. Now, you know, you couldn't write those things. But back to the game at hand. Toni Kroos, now 34, he made an immediate impact on his return. Jamal Musiala scored the second early in the second half against what was pretty much a largely ineffectual Didier Deschamps Bleu Bleu, which, yes, did include Kylian Mbappe. So, you know, it's a friendly, Derek, but it's away. They needed to break a drought. They've returned Toni Kroos back. What do you make of this? Is this the first sign of a re-emergent Germany? What are your thoughts?
Well, it's certainly a good start, because their recent performances have been been very poor. And as you said, you know, no host team wants to go into a tournament underdone, and there's no prouder team in European football than the Germans. So yeah, I think we'll hope that this is the start of good things to come. I noticed Kai Havertz got on the score sheet. You know, I'll never lose an opportunity just to talk about Arsenal in any context in this podcast. But clearly, his career at Chelsea had gone into the wilderness, and he was one of the most well sought after young players in European football at one time. So I think, you know, I'm sure they'd be very happy to see him back up and firing. It will certainly help. So yeah, I think they will pull it together for the home tournament. I think they will find some form. And look, I thought France are probably the favourites for this tournament, but just like England, they're showing vulnerability here. So, you know, it could be fairly open, Rob. It really could be fairly open by the time this thing starts. There is not a indomitable team here. You know, there's teams with great pedigree and great squad lists, but who will come out on top? Very interesting to see.
Well, you remember the last time Germany hosted a huge tournament, the World Cup, of course, in 2006, which Australia famously remembers. But it was the precursor to an era for Germany. Then under Jürgen Klinsmann, they some amazing names emerged out of that squad, and they went on to win the next World Cup after that. Now, your team of the week, you've gone for another international powerhouse. I go with Germany. You go with?
The island of Alderney, which was, of course, occupied by Germany in the Second World War. And anyone who is a World War II history buff should learn about the Channel Islands and the occupation there. It's a fascinating and sometimes harrowing story, but I digress. Now, regular listeners of the show will know that I hail from the Channel Islands, or I come via the Channel Islands. I like from time to time to bring insights from the Channel Islands into this podcast. I spoke about Alex Scott for Bournemouth and now England. He's made his England under 21 debut recently, going really well, the Guernseyman for Bournemouth. But I wanted to talk about Alderney. You know, Alderney is a small Channel Island that not many people know about. They know about Guernsey and Jersey, the slightly bigger ones, but Alderney is the third largest of the Channel Islands, but not a massive place. Every year, the Channel Islands play off for what's called the Marathi Vase, which is nearly always competed for by Jersey and Guernsey, the two main islands. But
does it deserve the sobriquet Time Honoured?
Oh, it's certainly Time Honoured. You know, it's big if you're from the Channel Islands, that's for sure. And local bragging rights are very important. But every year, either Jersey or Guernsey have to play off against Alderney. Every year they have to play this game. Now, Alderney's got a population of 2,167 people. So that's versus 70,000 in Guernsey and 100,000 in Jersey. Got to remember, people like Guernsey, they've got a team in the Isthmian League South, which is pretty low on the English pyramid, but it's still on the pyramid and it's still a recognised league. It's always played in Alderney. Believe it or not, I did not know this before I did the research. The ground is called the Arsenal Ground. So I'm already, can't make this up. 1,500 capacity, although there just seems to be some kind of cottage next to the pitch. Their biggest ever win, Alderney, was 3-0 over the Falkland Islands in an inter-island tournament. So that's massive. And then the biggest loss was 18-0 to Jersey at one point. Since 1905, they have lost every single game apart from one. And in 1920, they beat Jersey in the semi and beat Guernsey 1-0 in the final to take home their only Marathi Vase to date. But unfortunately, over the weekend, Alderney lost 4-1 to Guernsey at Arsenal Ground. And this was the 104th consecutive defeat in a row for the 2,000 men and women of Alderney. And as they say, there is always next year.
Derek, that is some kind of drought. There's got to be some sort of Alderney curse that you could dig up, doesn't it? There's got to be some story to, you know, I remember, was it the the Boston Red Sox. There was a goat that was banned from a stadium. Well, no, that was the Babe, the curse of the Babe. I think I might be talking about the Chicago Cubs here. But yeah, and I'm going to set you a task, mate, to find there's got to be a curse. It'll be the Alderney curse of some description. It's over a century old now. So we need to find this out in some future episode of Stoppage Time. Can you take that task on?
I'll take the task on happily, and I'm just glad to give people a history lesson as well as a bit of a football lesson. But unlucky Alderney, there's always next season.
No, well said. I like it. Love a good football story, man. Okay, on to our hot topics. And again, we're going to hand it over to Edge and his pre-recorded package. Now, as a former member of the New South Wales Police Force, I do say this through gritted teeth because I have listened to what he's about to say. And I'm very proud of my time in the blue uniform, and having been to the Goulburn Police Academy circa 1986, it's part of my DNA. But unfortunately, I think what he's about to contrast here in the treatment of football fans versus treatment of rugby league fans in some incidents that occurred at a rugby league game is, well, I think Edge is entitled to point this out because there seems to be one rule for one and another for... Look, I'll let Edge tell the story.
Well, Rob, my hot topic is the New South Wales Police, believe it or not. We saw them out in force for the big A-League men's derby between the Sydney FC and Western Sydney Wanderers a couple of weeks ago, and we saw them harass and harangue Western Sydney Wanderers fans, which has turned out to be, in many people's opinion, a significant over-policing and over-controlling performance by the New South Wales Police. But on the weekend, Rob, the Sydney Roosters and the South Sydney Rabbitohs, a pretty significant local derby in New South Wales Rugby League, or the National Rugby League competition. Well, there's punch-ons in the grandstands. And where are the police, Rob? Where were the stormtroopers? Where were the, the public order response team of New South Wales Police to keep the unruly rugby league fans in check? Just again, double standards. It's hard not to buy into the narrative that the game of football and its fans are discriminated against by the establishment of the New South Wales Police. I'll tell you what, it's hard not to actually have that opinion when you see evidence like we saw on the weekend where a pretty significant brawl erupted between those two NRL fans and there was no policeman to be seen anywhere. Yet there seems to be just as many police as fans at the A-League men's derby games between Western Sydney and Sydney FC. So that's my hot topic. A clip for the New South Wales Police. Stop discriminating against soccer fans. Or if you are going to treat soccer fans like that, at least treat the rugby league fans the same.
So there it is. The footage is disgusting. All you see are security people at the stadium, and of all places, it occurred in the members area where I think are within our rights to hold a higher standard of behaviour, but some of the commentary on some of the footage that's out there on socials, the idiots that are filming it are barracking the fools on to fight each other. So yeah, I think the police around this country need to police other sports as firmly as they police football. So, fair point. Look, I'm going to go to a better story for my hot topic. It's Global Football Week. I know we talked about this in the main show, but I just want to briefly recap on it. So the exhibition games story inevitably gets a kicking in football, but it gets my top billing this week. And it's mainly because for the first time ever, a women's A-League All-Stars team gets to take on one of the giants of English football. And I speak of none other than Derek's Arsenal at Marvel Stadium on May 24. And it will be the main match where Steph Catley, Kyra Cooney Cross, Caitlin Ford will play an All-Star A-League women's game. And that will be after, the men's A-League men's All-Star game. play against Newcastle, and Newcastle will play at the MCG again. Of course, this will be the big headline grabber, one off, I should say. Ange Postecoglou bringing Spurs out. So, Derek, you've already mentioned in the main show, but just very briefly, I feel like this is a seminal moment in women's sport in this country. Who would have thought that an exhibition game would earn a description like that? But when you put a blockbuster on as the main match, the feature match, ahead of what traditionally has been the men's code and a Premier League team at that, it feels like it's a pretty important moment in time.
I think there are always these important moments in time in women's football at the moment, whether it's the record attendances at domestic and international games, and the raised profile of not just, you know, women's football here in Australia, but around the world too. But the very fact that we can have this carnival weekend of football that includes two major male Premier League teams, and then obviously one of the best women's teams, not just in England, but in Europe and the world as well. They're still in there, probably not going to win the title this year. They've left themselves a wee bit too much to do to get that job done, but they're still a formidable force. And then to have the three Matildas as the kind of crown jewels in this team, and they're all very highly regarded by the Arsenal faithful. They're all major first team players, so hopefully they all come across fit and healthy, and they're all able to take part in a competitive game. And let's hope it is competitive, because yes, you used the word exhibition there, and I slightly shuddered a little bit at the use of that word, just because it is, you know, we've been to a few of these, haven't we, and the paper planes start coming out in the second half and all the rest of it. Let's hope it's a ripper atmosphere at Marvel, and let's hope there's a great football on the pitch and a great chance to celebrate three of Australia's football stars.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's something to look forward to. And yeah, we can criticise, and for good reason, some of the exhibition matches over the years, but there's not every day that that our domestic fans are going to see those Matildas wearing their club shirt, and it'll be interesting to see whether there's an equal mix of Matilda shirts and Arsenal shirts on young women in that stadium. Okay, now Derek, no one can ever accuse you of not bringing the big stories to Box to Box. You're always the hard hitting journalist, and you like to take your football seriously, but not all the time. Your hot topic is
the Harry Kane statue, or as we've been calling it on the WhatsApp group, the Ufuk Tali statue, which by dint also means it's the Rob Gilbert statue. I felt there's more of a passing resemblance to you, Rob, particularly when you've got the facial hair going on there. So, look, if there's no use for this statue that was meant to be for a train station in Chingford, could we put it on a boat and get it over to Australia, and wherever Ufuk is, it can be there. Change the badge on the shirt, or $7,000, Rob. You know, you get the big bucks. You could buy it yourself and put it on Riversdale Road or somewhere like that, and put a Liverpool shirt on it or whatever you like. So, this is the saga of the statue that Harry Kane paid $7,000 for, and has
did he pay for
so
it?
Far. He did. Yeah, he paid for it. Oh, and it's been in a shed or a cupboard ever since, and the photos have finally come out. It's not as bad as the Ronaldo one. You know, that is just, you know, hideous in all the extremes. At least this one does look a bit like Harry Kane. You know, like, well, tell who this player is.
It sort of looks like a skeletal body, but if you just look at the head, which in the picture that you'll see online if you haven't seen it already, looks like it's made out of chocolate rather than bronze.
They do struggle. I mean, they're good. I was thinking about what the great sporting statues are. I mean, I know a few of them at Emirates Stadium. They've just put one there of Arsene Wenger. Obviously, the iconic ones around the MCG are pretty good. You know, I think they're pretty good renders of the people that they're meant to be. But I did land on what I think could be the best sporting statue. I just wonder, Adam, whether you can cue in a bit of music here to set this one up. So, Rob, the if you find yourself in Philadelphia and you head to the Museum of Art, at the bottom of some stairs, you'll find a statue. They put it in the gardens now. They moved it from the top of the stairs.
No, that's wrong.
Who's the statue of, Rob?
Oh, of course, it's The Rock, the great Rocky Balboa, Sylvester Stallone, mate. Icon of my teenage years. I still remember running up the main street of Guildford with my brother Tim after Rocky III taking on each other as Clubber Lang was defeated by the great Rock. No, I love it.
Well, yeah, it's a really good rendering, I think. It's obviously iconic. There's not a point during the day that someone isn't around that statue, and there is an inscription on the bottom of it, and it says, "It's not how hard you hit, it's how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward. That's how winning is done." Yes. That's what it says at the bottom. So yeah. Everyone will note that I've managed to round off this topic with a movie reference, and I will hand that baton back over to Rob and say, "Your move."
Ah, well done, mate. It's almost feel like I'm a bit part player in the Queen's Gambit here when I'm or even that Derek is the pussycat to my ball of twine. He's just playing with me and setting me up for another one next week. And I did get a tweet drop into my feed. Speaking of bronze statues, that the Greeks were pretty good at making bronze statues. I mean, back in 1972, the warriors from Race RIACE were raised from the Ionian Sea. So check that out. They were making better statues back 2,500 years ago than this effort of Ufuk Tale stroke me stroke Harry Kane. Anyway, if they do bring it out to Australia, I will happily attend the opening and have it renamed. Derek, thank you again.
Thank you very much, and obviously looking forward to the big game this weekend, City versus Arsenal.
Oh, of course you are. You can't wait, mate. And wasn't that a huge setup, sending Kyle Walker out to get injured and pulling out Bukayo Saka just to rest up and be ready for the game. I'm going to be getting up early for that one. And Michael Edgley, a virtual thank you. You're not here, but you were here in some sort of way. To our listeners, we hope you enjoyed this special edition of Stoppage Time. Please subscribe to all of our podcasts, Box to Box, Stoppage Time, of course, and Offside coming up soon, wherever you get your podcasts. Tweet us at Box to Box and follow us on X, like us on Facebook if you haven't already. And make sure you join us throughout the week as our podcasts drop and we go from one end of the pitch to the other in the World Game.